Bring out data and information.
I've looked down and got a pickup.
And DOT funds you.
While on a.
Oh, you got.
Isn't that a council request?
Do you live on a?
We got 48.
Okay, so you, is that, you do some farm work?
The internal service fund.
Good afternoon, I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Monday, February 26, 2007. This week, today and Wednesday, we're going to be looking at the Department Administration, and if members will just take a look at your budget books, you'll see that this is probably, you know, the one area that's got the most pages in it. They do a lot of things, and so we're going to be reviewing what they do over the next two hearings. Just for your information, I think next week we're going to be starting to hit, we're going to be wrapping up the budget books by next week and then start hearing bills to be on track in order to finish our part of the budget by about mid-March. Before we start today, we invited the legislative auditor to come in. You should have a copy of a report of their review of their financial audit of the Department of Administration. And this was released last fall, so this is the first opportunity I think that we've had to take a chance to look at this. So somebody from here from the Legislative Auditor's Office to present it. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Policino. I'm an audit manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And as you mentioned, we conducted an audit of the Department of Administration last year, and we released our report, and I'm here today to talk to you about the results of that audit.
Okay, go ahead.
The audit objectives were to assess the department's internal control structure, to determine if the department properly recorded its financial activity in the state's accounting system, and to determine if the department complied with legal compliance requirements. The audit scope was, we reviewed the Drive to Excellence, the Cooperative Purchasing Program, which we mainly focused on the Minnesota Multi-State Contract Alliance for Pharmacy, or MCAP, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. We also looked at selected operating expenditures such as payroll, professional technical service contracts, and grants. And we also looked at some land sales that was a one-time appropriation to them. The audit had seven audit findings, four of them related to the cooperative purchasing program, and three related to operating expenditures. In the Minnesota Multi-State Contract Alliance for Pharmacy, or MCAP, at the time of our audit, there were 42 states and the city of Chicago, which made up this consortium for which Minnesota pretty much took the lead on it. They acted in a fiduciary capacity. The purpose of the consortium was to obtain pharmaceuticals, supplies, and services at discount prices for health care facilities throughout these different states and the city of Chicago. The program was funded by the pharmaceutical vendors who paid an administrative fee to participate in the program, which was pretty much based on the volume of sales as well as what was actually being purchased by the health care facilities. And the state, in its fiduciary capacity for the program, executed contracts with the vendors, collected the administrative fee from the vendors, and also rebated any excess funds back to the healthcare facilities. Within that, the MCAP program, we had what we determined, we had four findings, all of which we determined them to be critical. What we found was that the department did not ensure that pharmaceutical companies paid the correct fee to the state. They could not verify whether or not the pharmaceutical companies were in fact properly calculating their sales and then determine how much fee was owed back to the state. They did not estimate the unpaid amounts. For example, for the financial statements of June 2005, in their financial report that was issued as part of the state's financial statement, they showed an estimate of uncollectible accounts or accounts receivable of $408,000. However, through our audit work, we actually determined that amount was closer to $1.7 million. So more than four times what they actually reported as being outstanding and due to the state, really they were not aware of that money was owed to them. We found that the department did not always deposit receipts in a timely manner. During the audit in May of 06, we actually found approximately 17, 18 checks that dated back over a year into calendar 2005 that had not been deposited. We also found a check for $90,000 that had not been deposited for over 2 weeks. We also found that the department did not always enforce certain terms of the contracts that it had negotiated and executed with the participating vendors. Primarily two of them were that, depending on what kind of a company you were, you either had a 60-day or 90-day time in which you had to pay any fee owed to the state. And we found that they were not really enforcing that one. And also there's an insurance clause in there whereby the companies were required to provide proof of insurance, and we found that they were not enforcing that one as well. Within the operating expenditures, we had one critical finding, and it dealt with a contract that they had, which initially started out as $12,000. It was a sole source contract, and it was amended 7 times, and as of the audit report, it was up to $340,000. And we also found that a lot of the amendments, four of the seven, the work had actually already been started before the amendments were actually properly executed. We just felt they should have been able to do a better job of monitoring the contract and ensuring that to try and guard against all these cost overruns. Our recommendations from the audit was that we think that the department should do a better job of honoring its fiduciary responsibilities by ensuring that all vendors pay the fee owed, that they determine the amount due from the vendors, that they deposit all the receipts in a timely manner, and that they enforce the terms of the contracts. And we also thought that the department should do a better job of monitoring its contracts. And I'll help you answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Pausino. Are there any questions? Okay, Sarah Olsen.
Well, coming from private industry where the checks come in, they got them to the bank so fast you can't hardly, you know, they rip the envelope open and it's off to the bank. I am surprised to hear that there's money sitting around like that. What were they lost, or what's the story behind that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the bulk of the 18 checks, they were actually, I believe, in one employee's desk drawer or cabinet. So they were there on site, and for whatever reason, they just had not been deposited.
Okay. Other questions? Oh, Mr. Cerulean.
Does that get followed up on? That sounds like malfeasance or something to sit on checks like that. I'm concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, as part of our process, when we would go back to this agency, we do follow up on all of the prior audit findings. And so the next time we go there, we would follow up on that finding itself. And also, as part of their requirement, they actually provided a response to the report where they said that they would be taking corrective action to ensure that that doesn't happen again. Those reports go to the Department of Finance, who also then could follow up on them as well. So there should be some follow-up in the near future.
And we will be hearing from the department. And you can see at the last couple of pages of the report is where the department did give their input prior to the release. The letter from the commissioner is dated October 5, and then the report came out a week later. So to the extent that some of the findings, it's usual practice. They run it past the agency just so they can comment on it before the report is released. So, other questions? Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Nobles and Mr. Paulson, and then we'll be hearing a little bit more from the department, and they may wish to comment on some of this as well, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We will then go to the governor's budget recommendations for the department administration. Commissioner, welcome back. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dana Badgerow. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. If I might, Mr. Chair, I would like to respond to the audit findings before I begin.
Yeah, go ahead. As long as this is fresh before us, go ahead.
Exactly. First of all, as you all may know and Senator Rest knows from my confirmation hearing, I come from a private sector background, and I happen to be a manager who generally welcomes audit findings because I believe they help management determine weaknesses and help shore up processes and business disciplines. Let me just say that in general, certainly we agree with the audit findings. They were valid. They were correct. And in many cases, we were distressed by the audit findings and have taken very aggressive corrective action. In particular, Senator Olsen, if I might, the instance that you referred to, the individual was we took personnel action immediately with respect to that person. We trained all the remaining staff immediately and put in place daily checks to ensure that the checks that were coming in were, in fact, deposited that day or the next day if we could not make the mail that day. So I think we've taken very aggressive corrective action in that case. With respect to the allegations or the audit findings with respect to the Minnesota multi-state pharmaceutical program, I have to say, and I think my response to the auditor confirms, this is an extraordinarily complex program. There are over 4,000 buying entities across the United States that buy from this contract, and they can buy any one of thousands of pharmaceutical products at a variety of prices through three distributors, all of whom have different systems. So this is, I'd have to say, a systems nightmare, not necessarily our own systems, but the systems of the pharmaceutical providers, the entities that are buying these, the prisons, the health systems that are buying the drugs from the individual distributors or pharmaceuticals. And so reconciling these systems is an enormous undertaking. But having said that, obviously we can't shirk our responsibility to collect the correct amounts. The very first corrective action we took was to replace the leadership of this entity with a CPA who himself had been involved in the program but has the financial disciplines that we believe are necessary to improve the performance of this program. Secondly, we retained a retired healthcare executive from the SCORE program, which is the Retired Executive Consulting Program, who worked with us to help develop new procedures to reconcile these monthly statements we receive from the pharmaceutical manufacturers with what the people tell us they're buying. So we now have new systems in place. They still are not mathematically precise, and I hate to say they will never be. The industry standard for reconciling these rebates is 10% accuracy. So for starters, we are now triggering a report and a feedback loop for anything that shows a 15% discrepancy, and we will, over the course of this next year, move to the point where we can trigger follow-up action, letters or correspondence with the pharmaceutical company anytime there is a 10% discrepancy between what we show is owed and what the pharmaceutical company is paying us. So again, if you want to dig deeper into that pharmaceutical program, our director of purchasing, Kent Allen, is out of the city today and would be available on Wednesday for more in-depth questions. But with respect to the other findings not involving the pharmaceutical program, let me just also say that we did take those findings seriously and did implement immediate corrective action. The one where the first one having to do with access to financial systems, you may know that the MAPS system is a very complex system, and we have a number of people in our department who have access to that system. And it is true that we had not validated the level of access for some of these people, some nine people, for a period of time. We went back immediately and corrected seven people's access to the system and restricted it more in line with their actual job duties. In the case of the other two, we had to do a little discussion with the Department of Finance to determine what was the appropriate level for them, and by July, we had corrected all of those levels. The next finding was the record dates, the recording of an appropriate record date for a transaction. Again, this isn't an easy one, and we have any number of people, over 20 people in our department, who are recording record dates on payments and contracts. We have since given extensive training to each of those people in all of the pages of rules that are applicable to how you record record dates, and I believe we have corrected that finding. And then finally, the last finding had to do with our some professional technical contracting, both the one mentioned by the auditor having to do with extensive amendments of a sole source contract, as well as filing appropriate reports of performance after the contracts have been concluded. Again, I believe we've implemented corrective action there. But let me just say that, again, as you'll see from my overview, which I'm going to start in a minute, this is a rather complex department with many, many funds and many different kinds of operations. So it is important for us to continue to go back and reinforce with our entire leadership team the need for business disciplines and following these accounting procedures and practices so that in February we had a management-wide training program, 2 hours, conducted for 58 of our managers and directors, reminding them once again of all of these rules. In fact, the name of the program was Admin Scared Straight. We wanted to emphasize that there are risks involved in all of these transactions, risk to the state, risk to the individual, and we wanted to get people's attention. So I think we have done all of those things. I again welcome audit findings because I believe they give us an opportunity to make those course corrections that are needed in this complex system we operate in.
Okay, are there any questions regarding the audit findings? Okay, I don't see any. Commissioner, go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair and members, I had planned on giving an overview of our department, first of all, because the vast majority of our department budget does not actually come before this committee. It is through internal service and enterprise funds and other kinds of funds. I was also prepared to go through very, very briefly each of our divisions or operations so that you got a kind of an overview flavor for what we do and then get into our change items, if that's all right.
Sure, that's fine. I given the complexity of your department, I think it would be helpful if we got an idea of what you do before we get into the details.
You have in front of you two items, one of which is our little brochure, which is our statement of our vision and mission, as well as our goals and some very fine print that talks about what we do. And we have published a four-page, three-and-a-half-page summary of our accomplishments, and I'll refer to a few of those here this afternoon in my testimony. But suffice it to say, our mission statement, which has been fairly recently recast, has to do with our customers. And our customers are, in most cases, other state agencies. State agencies do not succeed in the main unless we provide them the business support services that they need to get their jobs done. So we provide those services. We need to do them in an efficient way. We need to be always mindful of reducing costs. And obviously, we need to offer an environment where our employees feel like they can thrive and enjoy their work. But just at kind of a high level, we purchase $1.8 billion worth of goods and services. We maintain 4.3 million square feet of state buildings. In addition to that, we have 800-plus leases of private property throughout the state of Minnesota. We do acquire and sell land and buildings. We are the state's internal insurance company. We manage casualty liability risks for the state. We're the recycler. We issue licenses for archaeological work. We work on the U.S. Census and a variety of other things I'll talk about here. This last year was, a year of remarkable accomplishment for the department, and the one, I'll just point out a couple of these here on the page. The one I think we're extremely proud of was the completion. We do manage over 400 construction projects for the state, and one of the most important ones this last year was the completion of a BSL-3 ag biosafety hazard lab for ag products within the Department of Agricultural Laboratory here on the Capitol Complex. Last year, the legislature appropriated money for that lab needed for analysis of things like avian flu, birds, and other agricultural products that may be representing some hazard to the food stream or to humans. That's a very high-level air handling and other qualifications laboratory. There are only six in the United States. Most of these laboratories take between 6 and 12 months to construct, and we completed it in 2 months. In many cases, with specialized equipment, hand-holding the equipment suppliers, expediting putting day-to-day contract management in place. We completed the lab. It has been certified, and as a result, the University of Minnesota received a $34 million grant because this lab was in place and certified. So we're extremely proud. We think it's an industry benchmark to have been able to complete that lab within that time. We do save a lot of money through our lease negotiations. We saved over $2.1 million. The Lafayette buildings occupied by the Department of Human Services in renegotiations with that landlord. We are saving extensive amount by moving the Office of Administrative Hearings into vacant space in the Stassen building. And we just recently relocated the Commerce Weights and Measures operation to a new landlord, saving $250,000. We do negotiate contracts, and this past year we achieved 17% cost savings in those negotiations. It was a record year for selling of surplus goods. $7.8 million were sold at our online auctions, our live auctions, and a small amount through eBay. I think we're especially proud as well of the 65% increase in E85 fuel usage by the state's fleet. We have, as I mentioned earlier in our new mission, focused anew on our customer. And so a part of that is actually redesigning our website. It used to be you came to the Department of Administration's website, you'd have to know which division offered a particular service. Today we have refocused this website to our customers so that if you are a state agency and you want to order office supplies or sell surplus goods or set up a state contract, this home page will direct you directly to that page. And similarly, we've got now a very user-friendly front end for businesses and vendors and for citizens. And that's just, again, a symbol of the way we're looking at the Department of Administration now as the state's business service provider. Let me just mention that we did go through our budget guidelines, but I think I'm going to skip those for the moment and jump to a little bit about our budget fund, our general fund budget. This is not in the way of a complaint, except I think you'll find this from many state agencies. We have, this is an apples-to-apples basis, the same operations that we have today. If you go back to 2001, our budgets have been reduced overall by 29%, and we would like to think that the level of our service has at least stayed the same and in some cases improved. But here, I think, is what I really wanted to get at, which is that the budget that this committee approves and has cognizance over is, again, a relatively small part of what we do. For the last biennium, 74% of our budget was actually in internal service or enterprise funds, and I'm going to go into each of those here in a second. We also do have a fair amount, 8% in general fund grants that are really passed through to our department and not directly expended in our department. And so for the next biennium, it's not substantially changed. Internal service are 73%. Grants are down a bit. General operating fund is up a bit because of our change requests. So as I mentioned, 73% of our total budget is in these funds. We generally receive the money for those funds from fees that we charge to state agencies based on rates. These rates are established annually based on business plans we submit to the Department of Finance and have approved. So we have an annual business plan process, an annual rate setting process, and we do obviously hold those operations financially accountable through audits, through actually quarterly operations reviews that my leadership team has with each of these businesses. We do regard them as businesses within state government that have customers and they're fee-paying customers whose satisfaction is important to us. So here's another slice of that 73% broken out now into the several more important kinds of funds. And you'll see that obviously by far the biggest one are leases. So 45% of our budget is represented by leases charged to state agencies occupying state-owned properties. So we manage these state-owned properties. The total cost of operation goes into the cost, the business plan and rate-setting process, and we charge back to the agencies on a per-square-foot basis the appropriate lease for the given building. We set lease rates for each building. The one exception to that, of course, is the Capitol and the State Office Building, as well as the Vets buildings, which are covered by a general fund appropriation, which is in lieu of rent. But again, that's basically the biggest single part. The second biggest piece of the pie is our travel management, which is our fleet. That is a fleet that we maintain. I'll go through a little bit some metrics about them later, but it is basically the state of Minnesota cars that you see driving down the highway that are leased by state agencies for use by their people, either assigned to individuals or assigned to a pool. You'll see a couple of other large ones, cooperative purchasing, which would have included the pharmaceutical program we talked about earlier, a little over $12 million. Risk management, the insurance pool where we collect premiums, is 13% of our budget. So to the divisions, and I'll try to clip through these fairly quickly. Stop for any questions if you want to drill a little bit deeper into any of them. State Architect's Office is an office that actually manages the construction projects, as I said earlier, for 20 state agencies. At the moment, they have over 450 active projects, so when there's a bonding bill, we know that there's substantial work coming to this office, as well as a lot of the hazardous material abatement projects and some of the asset preservation and restoration projects that the agencies undertake are managed through project management specialists in this department. It's 19.6 people. I mentioned the Ag Lab, but in addition, the Veterans Service Building was recently renovated. We're nearly complete with that renovation. We did have a flood in the Centennial Office Building, and this office helped with that recovery and restoration of the Centennial Office Building.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Olson.
We're lucky to have Senator Kubley's great interest in geothermal heating, and I'm just wondering, and I know you spoke about savings that you had with just turning down the thermostats and those kinds of things, but as the state has so many office buildings and those kinds of things, what are you looking at as far as being more greener and those? We just hear about some of the power companies building a new building with solar for water heating and all of those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, we're all over that subject. We too believe very strongly that we need to be following sustainable building guidelines. The whole topic of green operations and green buildings, I think, is worthy of a second report back to you, if you will. I'm certainly not the person who should be giving you all of that technical detail, but we are doing a lot with respect to sustainable buildings. We are doing a lot with respect to energy conservation, and you'll see a little bit later a fairly modest budget request for recommissioning of state buildings to get even further energy savings. So if I could defer the question, first of all, to somebody who knows a little bit more about it, I think we would like to come back to you with more detailed information.
I have a question now. I mean, you're talking about $500,000, or just on that plant management, $500,000. And this presumably is the cost we would have, but if we're conserving energy, there should be a savings. So wouldn't one offset the other? Why do we have to invest to save?
Mr. Chair, we believe... let me back up to say that there was a governor's executive order which requested that we conserve energy by reducing energy use in state buildings by 10%. We believe we were able to come close to that last year. We don't have the final fourth quarter numbers, but we know that through the third quarter we achieved savings of 7%, but without investment. I mean, literally with just greater employee awareness by managing thermostats, by training building maintenance engineers in some new techniques, but without a single real investment in new systems or energy recommissioning. So what we're now asking for is, in fact, again, a small amount of money which will fund 20 to 25 projects. It does, in fact, result in energy savings of between 5 and 15% per project, but not during the biennium. And that's the issue with many of these investments. They do pay off, but their payoff periods can be even 7 to 10 years because of the size of the investment required.
Sarah Kubley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. You know, back closer to the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the $7.8 million that you had gained from the sale of excess materials. Can you expand on that a bit? Or, you know, is that across all departments of the state? Or, okay. You know, I guess part of the concern that I have comes from people who live in my district that, you know, they're concerned that the sale of equipment from the MnDOT maintenance shops has limited their ability to remove snow and to mow their road ditches and those kinds of things in a timely fashion. And so I guess I'm wondering, you know, why those steps were taken when, you know, clearly an event like we had this last weekend indicates that we need all the equipment we can get.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, we have no role in declaring state agency property surplus. However, by statute, once it has been declared surplus, we are the outlet for the sale of that equipment. So the equipment comes to us after the agency has made its business decisions to dispose of property. The $7.8 million in proceeds that we obtained goes back to 90% of it goes back to state agencies. We retain 10% because we maintain a warehouse in Arden Hills, and our cost of operation is covered by that 10%. So I can't directly respond to your question except to say that any proceeds we received on behalf of MnDOT, 90% of them went back to MnDOT for their use.
Okay. Other questions? Go ahead.
Real Estate Services, this is the small unit, just five people, that manages the 890 leases currently across the state for leased property that is occupied by state agencies. In addition, we offer a space planning service so that if an agency is moving into leased property, we help them lay out their offices, their modular furniture, so that they can optimize the space that they're renting and therefore reduce the amount of space that they're renting. I think I've mentioned a couple of those highlights already.
Now, you're asking for about $7 million for the real property enterprise system. Could you spend a little bit of time explaining how you manage it now and how the $7 million is going to be used to change that? And, do we sell land now and send money in the general fund? Explain what's happening here.
That's a multi-layered question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Let me address the last part first. Over the last two biennia, the legislature, I think as part of its budget balancing, has required that the Department of Administration sell surplus land. And, in fact, this last biennium had a $6.4 million requirement against which we are still trying to meet that goal. We're struggling to meet that goal, quite frankly. So the sale of surplus land occurs as agencies declare the land surplus, and again, we've been returning those proceeds to the general fund based on legislative directive. The real property system, if I could be permitted, I would like to defer. We have a number of slides dealing with it later. We're actually going to show you what the system looks like with a couple of screenshots so that you can see the kind of data that we will get. It will not just manage the 890 leases. It will manage the 5,000 buildings that the state of Minnesota owns, about which it today does not have a comprehensive set of data. So not just the buildings in the Capitol complex or those managed by the Department of Administration, but the buildings and land managed by 22 custodial agencies throughout the executive branch. So this is an enterprise system which will go well beyond the properties, leases that are managed by Department of Administration. So I'd like to defer, though, what it will do, okay, what you'll get for the money, until that point, if that's possible.
Okay, go ahead.
Information policy analysis is the state's data practices set of experts. It's 4.5 people. They issue opinions. In fact, 60-plus opinions were issued last year giving advice to local units of government or members of the public about their use or exercise of the data practices laws, which, as you all know, are fairly complex. We do handle 8,500-plus inquiries a year.
I had a question on that. Now, I've probably spent more time dealing with data practices than almost anybody in the legislature over the last 14, 15 years. Well, Sarah Limmer has two, yes.
I'm close.
Yeah, you've been close, yeah. You came in.
We appreciate both of you.
Yeah, Sarah, yeah. Now, the information policy analysis.
He still doesn't see it my way, though.
Yeah. Well, if you vote for the bills once in a while. But they charge other agencies, as I recall, but then they have to give advice to them. And is that kind of a built-in conflict there so that basically they're having to, you know, here, we'll take your money, but you may not like our answer? Or I don't know how, if the way that it's set up to bill the agencies for the advice that you're giving is helpful, because sometimes I've seen over the years the agencies come in and they're just not happy with what the information policy analysis unit says. I mean, they try to be honest and straightforward, but the agencies are sometimes going a different direction. And who's paying the bills and what advice are they given? So can you comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I mentioned earlier this entire department has had a 29% reduction in its general fund over the last few years, and this unit is no different. It has suffered its share of budget reductions. We know that we must maintain a critical mass of staff for this operation. We can't. There's a number below which we cannot go and actually provide the advice that is needed. So we have, over this last year, supplemented the general fund appropriation in a very small amount. And I don't have the amount at the top of my head. It's well less than $100,000 for sure, with a contract or two to work with agencies as they are setting up systems at the front end to provide some preventive kind of measures to make sure that things are done right. Certainly, in those cases, we would not issue a data practices opinion because of the potential for conflict. So, to that extent, in the two cases that I'm aware of where we have been providing a fee-for-service, it is not a fee-for-service, literally. It is an interagency agreement. We have constrained ourselves from issuing opinions, advice. But as a matter of practice, we don't issue opinions, for example, concerning the Department of Administration, just for that reason. So there are certain areas where the issuing of opinions is certainly discretionary, and there are certain areas where we've exercised that discretion where there's any suggestion of a possible conflict.
Thank you.
Risk management. I said earlier that this is our insurance company within state government, a little known fact that we actually have this asset. We are currently insuring over 14,000 vehicles, which includes not only all state agency vehicles, but vehicles for the MNSCU system. And 100 state agencies and entities, and $9.3 billion in property. So property and casualty insurance is provided, again, for MNSCU and state agencies. We've had extremely good operating experience. We use actuarial estimates to determine the premiums, and then at the end of each year, we rebate to agencies any excess over our experience, the difference between our actual experience and what the actuaries would tell us we need. So we did just rebate a $1.036 million dividend, and it is the 11th dividend out of 12 years. Right now, however, we have a particularly strong interest in preventive measures, and we have just this last year, working with the Interagency Fleet Committee, been working on a safety campaign to reduce our claims experience in automobile claims. And I think it's paying off. We measure monthly how we're doing on our automobile claims, and we are experiencing fewer claims.
Mr. Chair.
We'll see.
Is this a self-insurance pool then, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, it is largely self-insured. We do have reinsurance for extraordinary risk, and have had to tap into that reinsurance on a couple of extraordinary losses.
In our county government, we had a pretty big problem with hitting deer. Are you finding that on the statewide system also?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, I don't have the breakdown of the numbers of kinds of claims we get, but we do get many claims, and I'm confident that's probably one of them. As an aside, one I found extremely interesting is we get a number of claims when the Department of Transportation is out striping roads. And the striping of roads leads to paint splatter on automobiles. And we have actually, this is another one of our preventive measures, we've gone out with the stripers and helped them minimize the amount of splatter, and therefore we have reduced the amount of such claims. But I can't address the deer strikes in particular. Communications media is perhaps not exactly accurately named. This used to be our print shop, for example, and we got out of that business. It is today the agency that provides central mail service for the Capitol Complex and for state agencies in and around St. Paul. It also provides office supplies to state agencies. About $6 to $7 million worth of office supplies are provided. And it publishes the State Register and then finally manages the Minnesota Bookstore, which used to be over here in the Ford Building, but now is several blocks east of the Capitol Complex and is a walk-in bookstore where you can buy state publications and other products. Travel management, as I said earlier, is our fleet. I think I've covered it fairly well. The only thing I would mention when I was in here talking about the governor's Drive to Excellence, there is a Drive to Excellence project which involves the consolidation of our fleet information and the better management of our fleet on an enterprise basis. State demographer, we'll be talking with you later about a small budget request to support the 2010 census. I think we all know about the demographer and the rich information that he and his staff provide to us as we're doing projections of all kinds of things. But in particular, we're very interested in the 2010 census because of its implications for redistricting and federal funds availability. But I won't steal his thunder.
I think one of the things we want to find out is the money going to, is this amount sufficient? Because the legislature only looks at this number once every 10 years. But the reapportionment of seats, Minnesota is in line to lose one of its congressional seats. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're not shortchanging ourselves in this area, and we get a good count, because if we don't do a good job, as I say, we'll be down to 7 seats in the U.S. House.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gillespie will address just that issue here.
Thank you.
Shortly. Land Management Information Center is a nation-leading GIS provider. The data collected by this entity, the systems that are maintained by this entity are available to citizens, to local units of government, to other state agencies, and provides a rich resource as we more and more rely on geographic information to make business decisions and to implement other programs.
So if we're relying more and more, they're reducing the amount that we're going to be funding this program.
Mr. Chair, I will simply say that the appropriation for this entity during the last biennium was one-time-only funding. And so what the governor's budget does is simply abide by that one-time-only funding, and in effect, it is a reduction in its general funding. I know that there's a tremendous amount of interest in this subject, and we've, I believe, at the request of your committee administrator, deferred that topic until Wednesday, because there are so many members of the public who want to provide testimony.
And I want to call it to the attention of the Budget Division. Sarah Limmer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our caucus, too, is concerned about this particular line item. Is it true that perhaps the previous biennium there was the FTE was close to $15 million, and now the 08 and 09 FTEs are now at 8.8? That appears to be a significant drop-off. Is that one-time money? Does that represent the entire difference between those two figures?
Wisher?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I couldn't I didn't get the 50 per, it was not a 50-people operation, so I'm not relating.
No, Mr. Chair, I didn't say 15 people. I said $15 million was attributed to FTEs in 06 and 07. At least that's the figure I've been given. And if you look at your figures, fiscal year 08 and 09 on FTEs are 8.8. And I was just wondering if the drop-off from one-time money to what is proposed at the 8.8, is that difference equal to the one-time money? Or have we moved that around from other areas?
Mr. Chair, The numbers shown on this chart are, in fact, the 06-07 budget of $3.358 million, which was, in fact, ongoing. It is, in effect, the historical budget for this unit, although it too has sustained many, many reductions, but proportionate reductions, not drastic reductions. During the last biennium, the governor proposed a very substantial reduction in the Land Management Information Center, which the legislature did not accept, and maintained same level funding for LMIC for this current biennium, but put in the language that it was for this biennium only. So I think those are the facts. I don't have the FTE numbers right here, but I'm sure that when we provide LMIC information on Wednesday, we'll provide that.
Mr. Chair.
And as I say, we will look at it this more, much more detail on Wednesday. Sarah Limmer?
Yeah, maybe I could even hold my questions, but does the fiscal year 06, 07, and then the ones above it, 08 and 09, are those FTE figures? They don't seem to be, especially when you have a fiscal year 08, 09 equaling 1.84 million, and then you have another reference to fiscal year 08 and 09, but separately FTEs. And I'm... when we meet on Wednesday, perhaps if you brought more details in line with the difference of the what some people think is a severe falling off of FTEs from the previous biennium, and I'd like to know that, and also how that correlates with the one-time monies that you've made mention of.
And members, if you look in your budget books under on the admin tab on page 47. On the bottom line, it shows 14, roughly, FTEs for the 06, 07 biennium, and then 8 plus in 08, 09. Commissioner?
So there is a drop.
Yeah, there's a drop. If you look on page 47 of the budget book. Senator Olsen?
Well, I, too, look forward to hearing more about this on Wednesday, but I do have a question about entrepreneurial initiatives on something like this. Coming, like I've said before, from county government, a lot of departments are able to pay their own way with charges for services. Is that something that can be looked at? I'm not sure how this is going to be handled with a request that's less than what's probably needed to operate the department. So I'm just curious if there are other avenues to produce revenue to maintain a well-used and useful department.
Well, perhaps maybe on Wednesday they'll address those issues. See, there's a lot of questions in this area, I think so. Okay.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yeah, we do have an enterprise element to this, which does, in fact, receive both grants and monies from state agencies and other users. So there is an entrepreneurial element to this as well, but it isn't consistent. The general fund monies go to maintain that critical mass, the core of its efforts. The project-specific work tends to be funded, in some cases, by agencies who are able to pay. Okay. The Environmental Quality Board is also housed within the Department of Administration as a remnant of the former Minnesota Planning Agency, 6.8 people. They are in the process of doing rulemaking around a number of interesting processes, including shoreland development. They did just this last year go through some rule revision, and I don't know that I need to say more. This is the staff support for the board. Although I am a member of the board, it is chaired by the Commissioner of Department of Agriculture, Commissioner Hugesson. The Office of the State Archaeologist is a very small two-person operation operating out of Fort Snelling. This is the function within state government that actually licenses archaeological field work, coordinates the Minnesota Archaeology Week, but works in close cooperation with both private sector, public sector, and the tribes with respect to issues having to do with human remains and other archaeological sites throughout the state of Minnesota. We have this past year, I think, spent a good deal of time working closely with the tribes, with the Indian Affairs Council and others, to open up communications and have a better working relationship with them around these issues. 269 archaeological projects licensed last year. STAR program is system of technology to achieve results, which is within our agency, a small unit that receives substantial federal funds, in fact receives no general funds, and provides advice, assistance, technology loans, loans of equipment for assistive devices to help persons with disabilities live more productive lives. We did just this last year start up a website that has been now copied by a number of other states, which provides reuse for assistive devices. When a person no longer needs a particular device or perhaps has outgrown it, they can list it on this website, much like eBay, and make it available at reduced prices to others who may need it.
So, but you're dropping from 2.571 million in the current biennium to 928,000. Is that what does that mean as far as this program, the service?
Mr. Chair, that's largely, of course, a function of the federal government budget for this item. It is the money that is currently appropriated. We don't know what might happen with the next round of budgets at the federal level. The money required to sustain this is obviously relatively small. The money, the difference between the sustaining three people, goes out in grants. And so we place grants throughout the state of Minnesota to help agencies, entities, private sector entities who are involved in designing, making assistive technology available to citizens.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a personal comment. My daughter worked for this program for 6 years. A number of years ago, I think, when it was just getting started, and she had a great experience there, and it really is an outreach program across the state for people with disabilities to not only achieve results, but just really positive changes in their lives through assistive technology. So I'm glad to see that it's still going, even if the federal government has seen fit to cut the appropriation there. So just a comment.
Okay. Go ahead.
The Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities is also housed in our department. The small staff, two-plus people, supports this council. This is, a council of appointees, of advocates, self-advocates, private citizens with an interest in ensuring that those with developmental disabilities have greater access to services. They provide self-advocacy programs. Their particular interest today is in ensuring that more people with developmental disabilities are productively employed, making living wages, and their most recent initiative has to do with a very interesting process of digital imaging. And a program involving 17 clients, developmentally disabled clients, in the Department of Human Services won a national award. This program was fostered by this council and has a goal of employing still more people in the digital imaging world. Then I have just a couple of sort of support services here, administrative management services. These are the HR and fiscal and commissioner's office services that support our agency, and including the one-person office for the Drive to Excellence. This is the office into which we would place the Office of Grants Management that I'm going to talk about in just a moment. Materials management is our purchasing entity for the state of Minnesota. 67 people. It is one certainly our largest professional operation. It does manage a tremendous volume of work, professional and technical contracts, construction contracts, and the purchase of goods. It is also where our surplus sales are conducted. It is the unit that would manage the targeted group disparity study, which we are going to talk about later as well. Management Analysis is an in-house consulting firm for state government and local units of government. It is 23 people who provide strategic planning, facilitation, conflict resolution, analysis, program analysis, for state agencies under contract. An agency chooses to use this. They're not required to use the Management Analysis Division, but our structure is such that it's quite competitive, and the services are provided by people who are not only talented but also know state government. So they tend to have not as steep a learning curve as a private consultant. But this is fully supportive by fees, no general fund appropriation. I should take that back. There is a general fund appropriation, relatively modest one, that does go toward the support of legislatively directed studies and other general fund support activities. It does some work for the governor's office. So now we come to the change items. I'm going to skip land management information because, as I said earlier, we'll come back to that on Wednesday. But before we do that, I just want to say a word or two about our process. Our process was covered in an earlier slide, but I'll refer to it from memory. Essentially, we established a number of priorities as we went through all of our budget requirements. And this is an unusual year for this department because we probably have more change items than we maybe have ever had. But we first of all looked at the things that we are legislatively mandated to do, that we are required to do by executive order, and that state agencies require to get their business done. Then we looked at the next priority were things demanded by citizens and those that went, again, to public use. So we went through and prioritized the stuff that absolutely has to happen, and I'll just use as an example of that the disparity study. We are under a legislative mandate to provide a preference to disadvantaged businesses as they apply for state business. We are unable to support that preference legally unless we update our disparity study. So we have a kind of a tug and pull here with respect to a statutory requirement, but without the factual basis upon which to pursue that. But let me now turn to the first of our change items, which is the Office of Grants Management, and say that, first of all, it is a project that came out of the governor's drive to excellence. One of the six projects initially kicked off by the governor back almost 2 years ago was one that looked at how we provide grants to state agencies, how state agencies administer grants. And it found a tremendous amount of variety and inconsistency in how those grants were awarded. So the numbers of grants are astounding, over $1 billion in outgoing grants, way more than that in incoming, and each agency does it their own way. They mapped all of the processes, for example, and of 24 agencies awarding grants, there are 24 separate ways of making payments to grantees. And so this inconsistency and this lack of an enterprise approach is making life difficult for the people who are applying for grants and is, quite frankly, also not giving us the full picture of how we deliver grants across the state. We think there's a great opportunity for internal efficiency in how we do this work and for external customer service improvement if we can establish a very small, two-person grants governance office within the Department of Administration that would provide system-wide approaches, best practices, common approaches, templates, forms, contract forms and terms, as recommended practices for all state agencies. This was a recommendation of the Governor's Drive to Excellence team. It was a multi-agency team that came up with this recommendation. But then coincidentally, I believe this committee has heard from the Office of Legislative Auditor, who found very similar kinds of findings with respect to these grants business practices. And similarly, the OLA is recommending that we put in place this greater discipline in the form of a small office to standardize these practices. So I don't know if I have any of my fellow testifiers here. Yes, Mary Ellison is here from the Department of Public Safety, who would like to offer a comment or two.
Okay. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I'm here today just to support this budget request. As Commissioner Badgero mentioned, there was a Drive to Excellence team that came up with this recommendation. I was the team leader of that team. And we looked across state agencies, as Commissioner Badgero said, and looked at how grants are managed and felt that this was a very, very significant step in having more of an enterprise-wide approach to the management of grants and also to make it easier for people that are applying for grants. The team that I led had not only state agency people on it, but people from the Council on Not-for-Profits and also from cities and counties. So that's just a very brief overview.
Commissioner Badgero, I think we'd heard that there's going to be about, what, two or three full-time employees in this area. Is that about right?
Mr. Chair, yes, this budget request supports two full-time staff, okay. One part-time or seasonal staff, kind of an intern or student worker, if you might. And one of the key tasks of this small staff, in addition, that I didn't mention, will be to establish the requirements for an enterprise system so that we can better keep track of the grants. There's been, I think, a lot of interest in the legislature and elsewhere in just having a better handle on the amount of grants awarded by the state and to whom. And so this would also establish a system, the requirements for a system, that would help us do that.
Does this also cover, I'm sure it's going to cover training for the people who are going to be handling the grants from the state level, but will it also be providing training and information for the grantees? Because I think that that's where some of the problems wind up. They just don't know what they're supposed to do, and then we wind up having problems in the audits where the grantees are not managing the money properly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that that would definitely be one of the goals. I don't know that it would be a goal that would be able to be accomplished in the first year, however, because I think one of the things that needs to happen is that the best practices that the committee has come up with need to be institutionalized within the various state agencies. And there are staff within the state agencies that are able to, in fact, provide training to people that are applying for grants. So I would see that certainly as a goal. I don't know if it would happen within the first 6 months or the first year, but certainly that's one of the major goals of this effort.
Okay. Any further questions on grants management? Commissioner Badgero?
Great. Thank you very much. I will simply say, just to wind this one up, that Marsha Abner from the Council on Nonprofits has been available for testimony on a number of these hearings, and I think we probably didn't schedule this one as well as we could, but she does speak quite strongly in favor of this, speaking on behalf of her nonprofit agencies. I'm going to go next to the small agency resource team and ask Deputy Commissioner Sheila Rieger to come up and give you the information on this initiative.
Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Sheila Rieger, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about the SMART initiative, SMART standing for Small Agency Resource Team. I want to talk about three things today. One is how the idea first came up, what it really means, and then thirdly, why we think it's a good idea and what the benefits are to state government. Currently, the Department of Administration provides a full range of HR and financial resources to the Department of Administration and also to the Office of Enterprise Technology and to five small boards and councils. Some examples of the kinds of services that we provide are the routine kinds of HR services, such as vacancy filling, classification, benefits administration, new employee orientation, payroll purchasing, and accounts payable work. The customers we have are able to come to us and get fast and efficient service. They depend on us. They trust our staff. We've created good working relationships with those groups. We help them to get their work done, but also to follow rules, statutes, accounting principles, and to do things the correct way within the government system that we have. Currently, with that volume of people, the resources that we have within admin are at maximum, particularly with the Office of Enterprise Technology experiencing so much change right now. We are really stretched to provide good services. A few months ago, the Department of Employee Relations approached our department and asked us to consider expanding that service, the HR services in particular, to a wider audience of small boards, councils, and agencies who currently come to DOER right now for some of those routine transactional HR services. They indicated that they would be willing to transfer some of their staff along with that work over to our department to provide that service. also, at about that same time, the Department of Finance approached us and asked, likewise, if we would be willing to provide services to some of the small boards, agencies, councils that come to them for some of the routine financial work. Right about that time, agencies were putting together their change item requests, and it came to our attention that many of these small boards have asked for additional funds to actually provide these types of services. Now, finance, rather than award money to or spread the money out to some of the small agencies and boards, considered putting it within admin or creating the SMART, the small agency resource team, so that we could provide those services more efficiently. We were asked to put together a change item, and that's what we have in front of you today. The goal of SMART is really to provide HR and financial resources from a central location. This budget request supports 2.5 full-time equivalent positions plus associated costs, and it puts the resources within an experienced group of people who are knowledgeable, have years of experience, and actually can back each other up. If you have a small board or council with one person who does part-time financial work, and that person leaves to take another job or goes on a two-week vacation, you find that that board or council is in some trouble and is looking for help. Putting the resources within a team, we can provide backup. If the SMART system is created, we will put together service-level agreements with our customers so that we actually set standards, turnaround times, and so forth. So the benefit to the team approach is really clear. We're able to help those boards and councils stay out of trouble, if you will. You may have seen over the past many years that there have been audit findings, some lawsuits, some questionable financial transactions, so forth, because it is a very complex system. We think that we can provide good services to those boards and councils and help keep them out of trouble providing that support, or at a very minimum, should something arise, we'd be able to come in right away and help clean up, fix, prevent it from happening again. Now, since this initiative was put forward, you may have seen that the Department of Employee Relations is reorganizing and are proposing that 5 additional staff join the SMART initiative. So I thought I would just take a minute to talk about how that would affect this change item. It's important to know that with the 5 people that Dewar is proposing moving comes the volume of work that those people are currently doing. For instance, right now they assist bigger, medium to small agencies with some vacancy filling and some classification work. We would take that on within the SMART committee as well. So we now would enlarge our team and hopefully create efficiencies over time. So the additional 2.5 FTEs that we're asking for right now is really for work that is beyond the work that Dewar is currently doing. So I would answer any questions you might have about the SMART group.
There are about 5 boards or groups that now use this right now. How many qualify, and why aren't more boards, agencies using it? Do you have a feel for that?
Mr. Chair, members, correct. There are currently 5 right now, and one of them is only financial right now. We provide financial services for the Arts Board. Why aren't other people coming to us? Well, that's a good question. Number one, I don't think that we have the resources available to provide services to those groups. And I believe the system in place right now is that they provide it themselves. They have office managers in some cases. In other cases, they've tried to pool together. I know within some of the medical areas, they try to pool together to get some support. We're checking into some of those resources right now and finding out how we might help them.
Is it possible some don't even know that this exists?
Mr. Chair, it is, because it doesn't really exist right now. What we're proposing is to really formalize something that's very small within our department, simply 5 small boards right now.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? Oh, sir, we'll see.
And this isn't necessarily directed to SMART, but this concept makes so much sense to me that, and I've been talking a little bit to some folks around here that the state has had in the past a centralized computer program system or one computer department. And it seems to me that we've heard from this committee, it seems like every group is coming forward with, like the MAP system you addressed earlier, $6.5 million to limp it along to replace it with a $46 million system. I'm wondering, Commissioner, what your opinion would be to go back to a centralized department of technology in the state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, I was actually listening to the hearing where you asked that question, one of you at least asked that question of our CIO, Gopal Khanna, and I was I'm not quite confident that I fully appreciated his response, except to say that I think that's where we are going. I don't know that he said it as clearly as I would have said it. I think when this legislature created the Office of Enterprise Technology, it had just exactly that in mind. And it is an evolutionary process rather than the Big Bang or revolutionary process. There are states that have done that. They have simply said, with the wave of a magic wand, all IT will be centralized. And the state of Minnesota has chosen a little more deliberate approach toward implementation. But certainly we are moving there, and I believe that within the next couple of years, we will in fact have central management, coordinated shared services of most of the utility functions in state government, and much better oversight and coordination of all agencies' systems requests.
I'll admit I've lost track of the number of attempts we've had in the last couple of years to try to centralize information technology initiatives, and I mean this is the latest. We weren't doing anything prior to this. We just had different ways of doing it, and this is the current version of it. So we'll see.
Well, thank you. And I don't have the institutional memory, but I've been learning some institutional history that, you know, over the years past, it's kind of been ebbing and flowing. But you're right. I didn't hear him saying that the other day. What I heard him say was that, you know, finance uses this and revenue uses that, and ne'er the twain shall meet. I more appreciate the direction you're speaking of, but because we're talking about, you know, it seems like every department has millions and millions of dollars they need in technology, and then I followed up with a question about, you know, who, you know, why do we contract with contractors for years and years and years? Why don't we do this stuff inside? You know, why don't we have engineers developing our own systems and really have it be an internal process? I mean, I think that technology is what's going to drive government and make it more affordable. And I guess I appreciate you saying that's the direction we're headed, but I guess I'm a little skeptical on that. So I look forward to seeing us moving that way.
Yep. Well, sure, go ahead.
Hey, thank you very much. The next item is the one you were asking about earlier, Mr. Chair, which is our real property enterprise system, and I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Nikki Giancola to come forward. Her responsibilities include real property, and so she'll talk about the system, and I'll push the slides for her.
And members, I had noted on the earlier slide that they're currently spending about $755,000 and are requesting $7.6 million. So this is a big change, but go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Nikki Giancola. Again, I'm Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Administration. And I'm very happy to be here talking to you about this particular request. It kind of follows along the lines of what the Commissioner and the Deputy have been talking about. This is a request really on behalf of all 22 custodial control agencies in the state of Minnesota today. 22 agencies own and control property. Just by way of acknowledgement, as in most large organizations, real estate tends to be one of the largest investments. It's usually only second to staff. And here at the state, I don't believe that we're any different. In that regard, comprehensive, accurate, and easily accessible information about real property is vital if the state is going to make fiscally responsible and operationally efficient decisions. Again, the 22 agencies that control property do it in a variety of ways. They are mostly disconnected systems. They're anything from a standalone facility management type system to an Excel spreadsheet to an Access database. And in some of the smaller agencies, it's simply kept on Blue Line. The storage devices themselves, whatever they may be, are siloed somewhat like the agencies themselves. They're inconsistent in their content and their application. And in many cases, they're not even real time. So the information that you do pull up could be months, possibly even years, aged. In addition, because of the format differences, as you can imagine, consolidating all of this information to put it in a understandable report is literally impossible today. In addition, the multiple entry of data and the redundant searching for this information results in a tremendous loss of time. The project itself began, as Commissioner mentioned, one of the Drive to Excellence initiatives, and it was issued in April of 2005, and it was really to address two things, the need for a web-enabled, shared IT-type tool to manage our property, and the development of a corresponding governance system or structure. And the objective here is simple. It's to provide the state a single view of its real estate holdings, and it would serve as the common source for all of us to obtain information and make decisions at an enterprise level. Again, the budget request is $6.7 million total for the biennium. 5.6 of that is to implement, purchase and implement the system. We went through a very rigorous RFP process, and we, as a team, it was representatives from nine of the major agencies, plus finance and OET, several others. We settled on the Arcabus FM system. Now, this is a system that actually the state has a relationship with this particular system, but it also supplements it with a piece of software called VFA, and that is a capital planning and facility assessment tool, which the two together would give us this comprehensive view of our real estate holdings. The system itself would provide the critically needed technology infrastructure necessary to support and improve the four major areas of real estate facilities-related activities, the first being project management. That involves design, construction, bidding, procurement, scheduling, those types of activities. The second is real estate and portfolio management, which consists of lease analysis, administration, RFP analysis, strategic planning, life cycle costing, those types of activities. The third is facilities and space management, and this involves IT inventory, site and employee services, physical security, emergency management, and the whole realm of space management, including moves, adds, and changes. And then the final one is maintenance management, which is our predictive and preventive maintenance, warranty management, work order administration, and scheduling. So in other words, bottom line, this is all providing a common database and workflows that are required in order to be able to provide this timely and accurate property information on the state's 5,000-plus buildings. Right at the moment, it will not include DNR wetlands or transportation right-of-way lands. It's land only associated with buildings. I believe that this clearly supports good, efficient government. We need to share information. We need to all have access to it, and the only practical way to do that is through IT. As a data point, the state owns approximately 31 million square feet of space at an average replacement cost of about $200 a square foot. That represents $6.2 billion in assets that we own. The idea of implementing a $5.6 million or $6 million system represents less than one-tenth of a percent of that investment. So I think a very minor amount in comparison to what it is that we're trying to manage. There are many benefits to a consolidated enterprise-wide real property system. I'll just go through a few of them. It would improve our performance and cost benchmarks. We'd finally be able to, on a statewide basis, create a statewide master plan. The facility condition assessment portion that I mentioned earlier would allow us to identify and rank our maintenance, capital renewal, and renovation projects. It would help us estimate financial requirements and establish capital plans. Along with this, what we'd be getting is embedded in the system is industry standard costing information, for instance, RS Means, which many of the construction folks use to do estimates of their projects. We would all have access to that. Our projects would be built using those standard cost tools, and it would provide us current and standard both capital and repair cost estimates. And then the detailed information that we would gather would ensure that funds would be allocated based on the need and level of deficiency if we were all using the same tools and system. It would allow us to provide consistent drawing and information standards by using CAD files and information within the system across the enterprise. We would have this consistency in drawings. It would improve our turnaround time and our cost savings through better resource management. We would have the ability to provide self-service work orders to prioritize and workload them quickly, and to provide electronic resolution tracking. The legislature itself would be able to go into a system like this, enter a work order if you were hot, cold, had a need in your office. Today it's taken by a live body, but you would be able to, and I can show you a screenshot in a minute of what that would look like. It's very simple. And the idea of having that built into the system now, it's a record. It isn't lost in paper, and it would help us build cases for, say, for instance, numerous issues in a particular office. We'd be able to track that and build our plans based on that. I think a key piece of this is knowledge retention. There is a forecast that it could be up to 50% of our workers would exit state government by the year 2015. And having a system to capture and retain this intellectual property on real estate will be critical. We need a system now so that the knowledge is retained. What's currently stored in workers' heads is transferred to a permanent storage bank. And then reduced search time and access to more users is a key benefit of the system. I think I'll move on and just quickly show you a few of the screenshots. Yeah. I think this is more telling than anything.
And before you do, I think we got a question or two. I have one or two, and then Senator Loomer has
okay. A
question. In the Senate, we used to divide up the work in the budget divisions, and budget divisions would submit ideas and capital requests, and everybody had their own areas they would look at, and asset preservation or repairs or whatever. And then we've consolidated everything right now in the Senate, so we have one capital investment committee that I'm not on. I believe some members here are. Senator Pappas, I know, is on. I'm assuming that this will be able to generate some sort of a list that says, okay, you've got an armory that's got a leaky roof, you've got a human services center that, you know, has asbestos problems, this building needs a new boiler and like that. So it's going to identify all the needs in one spot, I take it, ultimately.
Yes.
But isn't it still sort of subjective as to what becomes number one and what's last? I mean, how do you wind up putting it in order? And the legislature can draw the line and say, okay, we'll do the first 25 projects and then run out of money, or we'll sprinkle the money throughout it and fix part of the roof here and do a little bit here, and so we can stretch it out. I mean, it's still going to be subjective at the end of the day, will it not? Because everything needs to be fixed.
Mr. Chair, you're right. I don't know that we will ever get away from the subjectiveness of it, but I think the beauty of a system like this is that, for me, sitting in administration, I would be able to see the requests that, for instance, DHS has or the Department of Corrections. We would be able to rank our, for instance, roofs on the same priority system. Now, I don't know that we will ever be able to judge one another, meaning agencies' program needs. We're all going to have to continue to do that, prioritize based on our programs. But I think for all of us that are involved in real property management as well as the Department of Finance, helping us all see that across the enterprise, at least we will all know what we're dealing with. Actually, the legislature would have access to that information as well, probably ask more poignant questions based on what they have seen. But today, we do all bring them to different committees, and it is very siloed in the way we administer it. I think a system we'd all have access to the information, so be it a roof, be it new buildings, looking at our backlog of deferred maintenance, we would all be seeing what is actually there. Today, we can't do that.
Mr. Limmer?
Thank you. If we could flip the slide back one, that first line, a real estate master plan for all buildings, How do you handle it now? Is there such a thing as a master plan for your buildings now?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I guess I would answer that in this way. I do believe that all of the agencies that hold property have a strategic plan. Administration has a strategic plan for the Capitol complex and so forth. But without having the ability to see the data for other agencies across the state, I don't believe that we're making the most efficient decisions today. And let me just give you an example. I don't particularly know what is maybe up in the northwest quadrant of Minnesota. I know basically what's on the Capitol complex. I know if it's I'm involved in a project up there. But if that happens to be a DNR building, I believe that today DNR probably is the only one that knows about the location of the building, what the occupancy of the building, the condition of the building. If DOT, for instance, had a need for space up in that area, having a shared tool that would show them, boy, DNR has a building up there, maybe I can talk to them. See, I don't even think the dialogue goes on today because we don't know what one another owns. So for a strategic master plan, if all of the buildings were entered into a system and we all had access to the building plans, the backlog of maintenance, the occupancy of the building, whether or not we had any third-party leases in the building, all of that type of information I do believe would help us facilitate internally a strategic master plan for the state. Again, and I'll just mention that a second part of this project is governance. The team is working on a governance structure as we speak. I think all of the players that are at the table are very committed to making not only the system work, but a strategic plan for the state work as well, so that we're all not just sharing information, but we're managing property in the same way. So governance is a piece of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lieber, I'm not familiar with how government maintains its buildings, but I am familiar with how private sector maintains buildings. And quite often there's a reserve fund of sorts in order to anticipate, let's say, a roof that is 20 years old, and you collect a little bit over 20 years and deposit it in the account. So when that roof finally goes bad, you have the money to do it. Or blacktops on a parking surface. Do we as a state, do we have a ready reserve where we're budgeting for that type of repair? I keep hearing of schools all the time with a leaky roof, and they have mold growing to the point that it's now a health hazard for students. But mold doesn't just grow overnight. It's usually a product of deferred neglect, and the problem doesn't just occur because there's one leak. It's a leak that's been there for 10, 12 years, and I always have to, in the back of my mind, wonder who's taking care of the buildings that our taxpayers have paid for, and why aren't they taking care of that leak? Tell me how.
Well, apparently they had a fund, and during the budget deficit years, some of that money was taken away. Is that
what happened?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think those are accurate statements. I will tell you that there are many fine building operators throughout the state in all of the agencies. No, they never have enough money, just like in private sector. There just isn't enough to keep ahead of the backlog of maintenance. But I do think our workers do a terrific job of prioritizing the work. I would tell you, I mean, at least for administration, where there are leaks in our historic buildings or whatever, we are on that right away. But it is simply a matter of the budgeting process. I'm not aware of any fund, emergency fund, to tap into if we have catastrophic accidents. I think what happens is agencies, depending on where they're at in the cycle, just reprioritize their budget to take care of those.
And as far as, you know, the inventory, we heard a little while back from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they're moving their offices from downtown Minneapolis over to the Revenue Building. Judge Krause from the Office of Administrative Hearings used to be the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. So he knew that some space was being opened up because everybody's doing electronic filing of tax returns, and they were don't need as many rooms now to store all these paper. He knew this, the space was available. So, I mean, just because he knew that, he was able to lay claim to the space and work out the deal. But who knows? I mean, a lot of these transactions, you know, you can't just rely upon somebody knowing something. You've got to have some place to go to figure out what's where and what's available. So, other questions on this part? Okay, go ahead.
I'll just quickly run through a few of the slides just so that you get a flavor of what this system looks like. This first one is an example of what we call a dashboard view. It's configurable based on the user. These first few slides are examples from private sector, but they all demonstrate the very powerful business intelligence capabilities of a computer-aided facility management system. The reporting is used to alert executives and managers to potential problems, and it's a vital tool for monitoring performance at a managerial level. The pie chart up in the top left corner there illustrates properties by use. This could be office, warehouse, garage, parking, if you wanted to see a snapshot of the type of buildings. Just below that is a bar chart that shows property by value. If we had all of our information in one system, you could quickly, as a dashboard, pull up information or set this if you wanted to see it every day, the values of the property by throughout the state. You could also set it to be replacement value or deferred maintenance, whatever you'd like. The property abstracts, which are in the right quadrant of the screen, show all the details about a property. And I think, wouldn't it be nice if you could have this available to employees or vendors or even the public to show them all of the details about a public building? It could include directions to the building, a photo of the building, even a possible link to GIS, which is another function that we're contemplating as part of this system implementation. And then on the bottom is building performance. And there are endless possibilities here for setting that, but mostly it's around performance metrics that would be important to a manager or a leader. The next slide is really just a continuation of the previous one on metrics. This one in particular is showing access to KPIs or key performance indicators, which would give you actionable information to work with and to guide your business performance. If you were a manager, for instance, with a responsibility for 5 facilities, you could get those 5 only on your dashboard. If you were a commissioner and you had hundreds of buildings in your portfolio, you could see those reports up of consolidation of all those buildings. You could set it to trigger you for lease expirations or operational increases. Or if you were a building manager on a daily basis, if you'd need quick and easy access to work request information or how your folks are doing on PM completion, you could see it on a screen such as this. The next one is showing a budget by program report in both chart and grid form. And this would allow you to view and project out your budgets for specific building systems. The condition assessment information, which I talked about earlier, would feed up into this type of a report. It would be extremely helpful in the capital planning and budgeting process, and it would provide a manager a compelling view of the outstanding needs of various building systems. It's kind of hard to see that, but the majority in this particular instance is asbestos abatement in the green, so you can see on a relative basis where you're at with needed work in different building systems. The turquoise is fire life safety and so on and so forth. The next example is showing building and floor inventory. This particular one is highlighting on top. The red section is the vertical penetrations going through a building. The one below is showing actually a headquarters floor, and it's depicting the private offices versus the cubicles. What this would do is help us enforce our space guidelines. We do have them, but if you could pull this up and quickly see assignments by type of function, you'd be able to better manage that activity. It would help in more accurately providing chargeback information. It, as I said, help enforce office standards. It would also help in our emergency planning. Today, I don't know how many of you actually see like an egress map for your space, but if you had it electronically and a building manager could update that based on changes that have occurred in the space, the ability to see that in a more timely and accurate manner would be here with an electronic tool such as this. This next one is a work request. It's a sheet that you would enter work request data on. I mentioned it previously. This is what all of us could enter a work request on, and it's as simple as filling in your name, and it would auto-load all of the rest of the information. And then you could track where that is at in process. We, as support staff, could monitor that and make sure that you get a resolution in a timely fashion. And as I mentioned earlier, all of that is contained then in the system. It's saved for us to build projects on in the future. This next one illustrates all of the details pertaining to a work order so that you can get a flavor for what we would collect on a work order when it was created, the priority, the contact person, the cost of labor and materials. Again, it allows for this information to be retained for history. It allows you to build a case for a capital budget request if it's going down that path. It would allow you to leverage contracts if, for instance, that you knew so many work requests are of a particular nature. It would help our contracting folks leverage contracts more efficiently, and it would also help us more efficiently schedule our resources. And then the final slide is a days to close report, and this is key for performance management for most property managers to see what their outstanding workload is and how far behind or ahead they are. With this on an enterprise level, we'd be able to finally calculate averages across the state and do a better job of forecasting by building. So with that, I hope that gave you a quick, pretty good overview of what the system looks like, and I would stand for any additional questions.
Okay, go on.
Mr. Chair, I just might add a couple of footnotes. Apropos of Senator Olsen's question earlier, this system will be, in fact, housed in and managed by the Office of Enterprise Technology because it is shared across 20-plus state agencies. And just to reinforce again, while this is in this committee and it is in the Department of Administration's budget, it is a request on behalf of those agencies.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Roebling.
I was just looking at the work order, and I was trying to figure out the work order priority, and it's, I don't know if, do you prioritize, like, this is immediate need, this is a two-week need, what usually comes in here?
Mr. Chair and Senator, you're exactly right. That is, priorities in most CAFM systems run 1 to 4, 1 to 5, 1 usually being an immediate need. I've got a leak. What else? Lights are out, power is gone. Those would be examples of immediate needs. When you move down the scale, it might be, I spilled something in my office, I need attention tonight, or when the custodian is coming next. I'm hot or I'm cold might be a priority too. Again, all of that we would set as a state and as a standard. I believe across the agencies today, we probably don't have consistent priorities of our work orders, and this would help us get there. But you're absolutely on the right track with prioritization.
Mr. Chair?
Thank
you. How often when you do set those priorities or those dates, are they met?
It is, Mr. Chair and Senator, very interesting. Because we don't all have this in a system today, some of the reports that would show you that very information aren't available to us. If we enter the information and our building operators close them, we can keep track of how many are on time and how many are not. Today, it's hit or miss. I don't believe that we know without a shadow of a doubt how well we're doing or how bad we're doing. I myself don't get a whole lot of complaints, so I'm sort of assuming that in the Department of Administration we're taking care of folks here on the Capitol complex fairly well. But I can't say that across the state, and I don't believe my fellow agency people could say that either. They really don't know, and having a system to provide them that reporting information would be wonderful.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay.
Um, The next change item, just talk briefly about this one. It was mentioned earlier. This is a recommissioning initiative. The request is for $500,000 for the biennium, and it's to fund the evaluation and repair of state building mechanical systems. And this is in an effort to reduce energy and return systems to peak efficiency. By executive order, state agencies are required to demonstrate the benefits of energy conservation and what they're doing toward that, and this recommissioning would assist them in achieving that. Recommissioning can really be thought of as giving a building a tune-up, if you will. It's a systematic process applied to existing buildings that helps you identify and solve mechanical problems that are either wasting energy and or making your facility expensive to operate. As you can imagine, building systems change over time as they age. The energy and operating performance may suffer, as well as indoor air quality can degrade. In addition, space usage and people densities can change, and the building systems as they are may no longer be capable of meeting the new performance requirements. And so recommissioning gives you that opportunity to reevaluate the building, checking the mechanical systems against their original design intent in order to optimize their overall performance. It can also be an opportunity to train building operators. Just as systems and people in buildings change, operators frequently change that manage the buildings, and this would give them a chance to get up to speed on the particular systems within a building. Literally, this is an activity that pays for itself. Many times in just a year or two, depending on the opportunity that you have, it's a very prudent facility management activity, but it does take some upfront investment to do that. So just to recap some of the benefits, it helps you conserve natural resources by helping you identify and reduce energy waste. It helps you lower energy costs. It helps you pin down and fix existing problems. It improves indoor air quality and occupant comfort. It increases equipment life in many cases, and it reduces the amount of staff time spent on emergency calls. I will also add that in some cases, energy rebates are available even to do this study-type work. Xcel Energy, for instance, does offer a rebate on recommissioning studies. And I think the commissioner mentioned that what this would allow us to do is recommission 20 to 25 buildings, we believe, in the biennium. And we expect to see between 5 and 15% savings as a result on reduced consumption of energy in buildings.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Robley.
Thank you. You know, I was wondering, I noted in one of the publications I was reading from, like, the Council of State Governments, that Illinois had either passed a law or there was an executive order that all of their buildings, the temperature in the winter be set at no higher than 68 degrees, and the evenings and weekends would be turned down to 55 degrees. And, you know, I've noticed around here, I'm over at the state office building, and I turn my thermostat down before I leave. But I don't think that's a common practice. And I'm just wondering, has your office considered kind of initiating some kind of a policy or I don't think we've ever heard of any in our building, at least not as legislators. Maybe staff knows, or our custodial staff might be aware of it. But we're burning probably more fuel than we need to, and we're being told to do this in our homes, that we should turn down our thermostats when we're going to be away for a while or overnight. And I'm just wondering about the practices in our government buildings.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the executive order that I referred to, it's 0516, requires building operators to maintain buildings within temperature ranges. Illinois was a little more drastic than we are, but I can assure you that here on Capitol Complex, the operators that are operating the buildings for the Department of Administration are following those guidelines. Private offices are a little tougher to regulate. I know in our office, all of the thermostats are turned down at night. And we make a conscious effort to do that. That's a lot of what, you know, temperature guidelines have to do with. It's just being conscious of that. But the building operators also have a requirement per executive order to maintain temperatures within heating and cooling guidelines. And I do know that it's been different for a lot of occupants in our Capitol Complex buildings. But I'm happy to report that there hasn't been any mutiny. It's a little tough, but all organizations go through it. And as the commissioner mentioned, we are seeing savings of 7% just based on those creature comfort adjustments that have been made as a result of that executive order.
Okay. Commissioner, did you want to finish up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just to further respond to Senator Roebling's concern, we too believe that it is a communications and awareness issue, and for that reason we established a website for state agencies and a newsletter to all state employees. Perhaps we excluded senators and their staffs, but that is called Saving Energy, and it provides tips not only on saving energy in your office, just simple things like don't push the handicapped entrance, but if you're able-bodied, because that wastes energy. A number of tips like that have been provided to state employees, and an awareness campaign was put together by our department and Department of Commerce. But again, we might have excluded the legislative staff and the legislators in our communications. Mr. Chair, at this point, we were going to give a quick informational overview of our two capital budget items.
Go ahead, yeah. I think this will be rather quick, so go ahead, yeah.
Yes, we have the two, one of which is just extraordinarily important to us. It is our agency's really number one funding priority for the session and has been for the last two sessions. So I'll let Ms. Jean Cola quickly talk about it.
Okay, Ms. Chair and members. For those of you that are not aware, the building here that we're talking about is the Department of Transportation occupied building this way on John Ireland Boulevard. The structural support system for the building that secures the granite panels on the exterior is failing, and that's due to excessive rust caused by exposure to moisture. The force of that corroding steel is powerful, and the rusting process is subjecting those 1,200-pound panels to extreme compression, which results in spalling, which we are starting to see more and more of, as well as vertical and horizontal displacement of the panels themselves. There has been measurable movement of many of the panels on the building, and I have some physical pieces that have spalled off the building here, if any of you are interested in checking those out. But I guess bottom line here is the failure to act is going to result in increased spalling and a heightened risk that a panel will fall. Our engineering consultants have stated that without a repair to the facade, a panel failure is inevitable. Each panel, by the way, the dimensions are 6 by 6 by 3 inches deep, and they each weigh about 3/4 of a ton. The scope of the work as well as the risk is increasing, which is why it's included in this emergency bonding recommendation. We have, based on the potential exposure to the risk management fund, an endorsement is now attached to the insurance policy for plant management that excludes this particular condition having to do with the granite panels and the structural support system. This is the fifth request that the Department of Administration has made for this project. The first was in 02. And I guess I would stand for any questions. That's just a quick overview of the condition.
And members, the Finance Committee met last week, and Senator Murphy had an amendment to take care of that, but through transportation bonds, and I think that's something that's going to have to be worked out, the proper funding mechanism. Technically, this budget division has oversight over that, but it's kind of maybe a pass-through, as I understand it, through the Department of Administration as to how that money gets done, but it's something the Finance Committee is looking at right now to figure out how to go on. If this committee wants to spend some time on it, we certainly can, but it is being acted upon in that committee, so.
Mr. Chair, I just might add along those lines. In previous biennia, in several of our earlier requests, this has been slotted as trunk highway funding, and it is not this year. We are asking for general fund obligation bonds for just a couple of reasons, one of which is that we don't really want to tie this project, which has essential life safety implications. As Ms. Giancola mentioned, this building is not insured. We are not insured for loss or damage caused by one of these falling panels. And it is therefore critical that we not tie this to a transportation bill that may have other implications and issues. This has to happen. We would really love to have asked for one-time funds so that we could have gotten started right now. So we're asking again for general obligation bonds just simply because we really want to make sure that, if at all possible, this happens this year.
Okay. And then?
And our second capital investment request is for property acquisition, $2.2 million to purchase available property at 639 Jackson Street. Just a little bit of background here. In 2006, the Central Park United Methodist Church notified us of the intent to sell the property at 639 Jackson. The state of Minnesota actually has first right of refusal on three of the parcels that make up that property. The property right now, it's at the corner of 14th and Jackson. It's kind of sandwiched between the state's 14th Street parking ramp and the Stassen property. And what this would do is it would provide an opportunity to acquire scarce capital complex land for both existing and future needs. I think in your packet you should have a colored map just depicting this particular parcel so that you can see where that's at. Again, it would help meet an immediate and critical need for visitor parking on the east side of the Capitol complex, and it would provide the state an opportunity for future development because land in and around the Capitol is scarce. If the state elects not to purchase, the property would likely be sold to another interested party. As a matter of fact, Regents Hospital currently rents some space in the building, and they've expressed an interest in acquiring the property themselves. So, again, we have a willing seller. The property is now tax-exempt, and this request would simply be able to take advantage of the opportunity of the property being for sale.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Since there's a structure already on it, then, would you rent... continue to rent space in it until you decided what other structure might need to be put on it, or if it's just going to be torn down for parking, or what is the plan?
Sure. So I'm not sure what we can rent it for, but yeah. Ms. Jean Cole?
Ms. Chair and Senator, our intent would be to use it on a short-term basis as surface parking. I think a couple of weeks ago when Judge Krause was here talking about the Office of Administrative Hearings move to the Capitol complex, one of their big concerns is where the council will park and the folks that visit to go to workers' compensation hearings. What this would do is provide, at least on a short-term basis, a critical parking need that exists on the east side of the complex. But truly, having it for future development in the long term is what is out on the horizon. I'm sorry, and yes, our intent would be to take the building down, not continue to operate it. The building is not in that good a condition right now, so we would not be obtaining it to keep the structure and operate it.
So, Mr. Chair, just two sort of summary points on that. Just while we are asking for general obligation bonds, it will be user-financed entirely and will be fully self-supporting with the parking fees that we would obtain from the meters.
Okay.
I think you all have just a bit more time. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
We do go until 2:45.
I would like to, with the permission of the committee, move to the census 2010 preparation, since our demographer is here and the person who would testify on the other two is not.
Sure.
So
will we you'll be stopping here at this point then?
Well, Mr. Chair, I could actually cover them at a very high level if you like, or if you want additional detail, Mr. Allen could be here on Wednesday.
But since we're coming back on Wednesday, maybe you can cover the rest of it. As long as we got the unless there's somebody here who's been waiting who's been wanting to talk about the other two items, but we know the demographer is here, so we might as well cover his item.
Mr. Chair, the disparity item, we believe there is some public interest in that, and we would anticipate there being some public testimony on that.
I haven't been taking public testimony so far on the governor's budget proposals. I'll outline, after we're done with your presentation, I'll outline where we're going to be going, but there'll be an opportunity for the public to testify on stuff, but I wanted the agencies to make their presentations. We'll get to that at some point.
But
welcome to the budget diversion. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer in the Department of Administration. We are requesting one-time funding to promote the 2010 census, and that funding would be similar to the funding that we requested and received prior to the run-up of the 2000 census and also the 1990 census. Census Day is April 1st, 2010, is now 3 years and 1 month away. We are requesting $60,000 in the first year, starting this year, this coming year, FY08, increasing to $240,000 in FY09, and then we will be seeking additional funding in FY10 and 11 to accomplish this task. The purpose of this request item is to ensure a full and accurate count of population for Minnesota and its jurisdictions. In 2000, Minnesota had the lowest undercount, we believe the most accurate count in the nation, and we would like to be able to duplicate that effort. The effort would have really two directions. One is a technical nature, and the other is a public promotional effort. The activities will coordinate with the U.S. Census Bureau and include work with local units of government, elected officials, including the members of the legislature, as well as other statewide elected officials, full count committees around the state, targeted activities to traditionally difficult to count populations, general promotion to the public, promotion of job opportunities, which prior to the 2000 census was actually one of the biggest issues that we had, was actually finding people during a labor shortage, and technical activities such as checking maps and address lists, checking early returns, and identifying potential errors in the data, and working with local units of government to try to resolve errors in the data. In fact, some of that work is already beginning. Today, I have one of my existing staff people is working with a person from the U.S. Census Bureau on a project called LUCA, which is the local update of census addresses. The census is a mail-out, mail-back kind of instrument, and so it becomes critical that all address units in the state be identified up front. And this is an effort to encourage local units of government to check the maps that the census provides, the list of addresses that the Census Bureau provides, to check those for accuracy. And we will be providing training and encouragement. As is often the case, it takes 3 to 4 times to remind somebody that something's important before it's done, and we will be encouraging people as early and as often as we can, which will be part of this effort. The benefits, really, there I would categorize as three main benefits to the promotional effort for achieving a full count for the census in Minnesota. The constitutional reason, U.S. constitutional reason for a census is to reapportion the U.S. House of Representatives every 10 years, and that's been true since the first census in 1790. At this time, Minnesota has 8 congressional seats, but it appears that based on the forecast we've done that the 8th seat is literally on the cusp. We are literally within about 2,200 people of 3 other states to receive that 8th seat, and so it's going to be a close competition. It'll be a difficult competition, and how fully we count the population will ultimately determine to a great extent the outcome of that race over the next 3 years. Secondly, in addition to reapportionment, is and also redistricting, is the large and federal and state programs that now use the census for allocation of funds. And just looking at 8 federal funds alone, the Marwick and Associates has done a study that that indicates that the allocation for eight federal programs amounts to about $2,900 per capita over a decade period of time. If we had merely had the average level of undercount in the nation last time, we would have lost over $40 million in funding over a decade period of time, and that's a substantial amount of funding. But in addition to the dollar allocation, there's also the fairness and equity of various kinds of programs. Some of the state programs are fixed pot programs where we allocate a fixed number of dollars according to the cities and townships around the state, and if someone is undercounted, if a particular city is undercounted in the decennial census, that'll be carried forth throughout the decade and represents an unfair allocation and an inefficient allocation to that particular city. So that we believe that that with this promotional effort, we will be able to achieve as accurate and as complete account as we possibly can.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie. Any questions? The state demographer. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I'm getting a few letters from constituents that are polled for some type of census that's been going on lately. And I don't think it's for redistricting purposes. It's to collect other data. And they continually ask if they have to answer every question. And some of the questions, even to me, seem to be rather above and beyond what really is needed for the purpose of a census. And I was wondering if you might have any knowledge of, is it true that a citizen has to answer every one of those questions? Because some of the, I can't remember them now, but some of them were a little more personal than what I think most people would be comfortable with. Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe you're likely referring to the people, the survey that people are likely referring to is called the American Community Survey. It's something that the Census Bureau has been ramping up this decade, that it's a very large and continuous survey. Approximately 60,000 households in Minnesota will be sampled each year. That actually will take the place of what is called the long form on the census. The census traditionally has been divided into two parts, a short form that everybody receives, and then a long form that a sample of households receives. The long form literally is a long form, and I remember spending an afternoon with the previous governor discussing point by point the reason for the specific items in the census. The American Community Survey carries forward the same questions as were asked in the census in the 2000 census long form. All of those are required either by constitutional or some kind of type of judicially interpreted constitutional reason or congressional act to be included in the instrument. And it literally takes an act of Congress to include an item in the instrument. The question as to whether or not people are required to answer every question on that has come up with in the federal government, and the Census Bureau asked to have this as this instrument be a mandatory completion item, much like the decennial census, and Congress has not agreed with that, and so that is at this time not mandatory to complete that instrument. On the other hand, there are some valuable pieces of information, and sometimes we think of things as being sort of an odd question, like not how many bathrooms do you have, but it was to a large extent that question that over the last 70 years has resulted in frankly, in Minnesota, nearly 100% coverage of indoor plumbing. In the 1930 census, many Minnesotans did not have indoor plumbing, and that was one of the questions that was mandated in the 1930 census and continues to this day. There are still some people that do not have access. So those are the types of questions that sometimes raise eyebrows, but they do still have a legitimate purpose.
And, Mr. Chair, what would be the consequence if you didn't? Is there a criminal or civil consequence?
Chair, Senator Limmer, there are no consequences except that you may be asked again. But if a person refuses, there is no action taken against the individual. That Congress has spoken pretty loudly to this point that there should be no, that this should not be a mandatory instrument.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, you mentioned that we need to gear up to hire people for the census, and that was one of the biggest challenges last time. I'm kind of wondering, though, aren't all the jobs offered by the federal government, and how does the state play a role in hiring?
Mr. Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, the relationship that we have is with the Census Bureau is a close operational relationship during the census promotional time. We oftentimes have a better understanding of what literally is on the ground in Minnesota than staff people in their regional office in Kansas City. We had identified prior to the 2000 census that the ability to staff the jobs, the positions for all of Minnesota would be a difficult task because our unemployment rate was so very low and our employment ratio was so very high that we simply didn't have very many people available to fill these kinds of jobs. The census is at each taking, each decade is one of the largest undertakings in the history of the United States. It is an enormous undertaking requiring tens of thousands of people in both office and field work. Some of the field work will begin this summer and will include, for example, walking up and down streets checking address lists. And on the one hand, we want to make sure that there are qualified people to do these jobs. On the other hand, we want to make sure that Minnesotans are aware that person who is wearing a census badge or a census identification walking up down the street with a book is not somebody doing something illegal or inappropriate, but in fact is really a census person, and we'd really rather not have them injured or harassed. So there are many elements to that, but one of the things that we did, just as an example, prior to the 2000 census, we were so desperate looking for people at about this time, February and March before the census, we were literally standing on street corners on Saturdays with census shirts on and blank application forms, asking people as they stopped for red lights if they would fill out an application for a job. We did actually find some people that were were available, but it was such a tight labor market that many people already had two or three jobs.
And Sarah Larson, you had a question, and then I want to outline what's going to be happening over the next 2 weeks, and we got to quit. So, Sarah Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gillespie, I'm curious. It's been suggested to me that the undercount, to the degree that we have some, and I'm glad to hear that we are lowest in the country, but that occurs largely in specific groups, perhaps mm-hmm. demographic groups, lower income folks. I understand more urban populations. So what can you tell us about that?
And you need to be brief because we got to be out of this room very quickly. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, yes, that is true. There are difficult to enumerate populations, both physically and also by language and resistance to government, and we will be targeting that and working specifically in those areas.
Thank you, Commissioner. We'll see you again on Wednesday and wrap up the Department of Administration. Members, let me just kind of give you an outline. We're getting right at crunch time. We will finish Department of Administration on Wednesday. Wednesday is also when the budget forecast will come out. We'll get our budget division targets shortly thereafter. Next Monday, we'll finish up our overview with the governor's budget, governor's office, the Secretary of State, State Auditor, Legislature. Wednesday, starting next Wednesday, we'll start looking at bills because there are things the governor did not propose funding for. We'll start hearing what other proposals are out there. We normally meet Mondays and Wednesdays. I've reserved, and we'll have to send an email out to remind you of this, but I've reserved the room on Friday morning, March 9th. That's a week from this Friday, because I don't know how many bills we're going to have, how much public testimony we're going to need, but if I need an extra day, we'll have to do it on that Friday. The following week, that's 2 weeks from today, that's March 12th, we're going to have to start putting this bill together. And it's not my intention to sit in my office and put together a bill and roll it out here and say, here it is, folks. I want to hear your input, your suggestions, what your priorities are. And then I believe then the following Wednesday, which is 2 weeks from this Wednesday, March 14th, that is when I think the Finance Committee is going to want the budget bill out of this budget division. So we're going to be done. In about 2 weeks. They're still modifying their schedule, but that's what I believe it to be. So anyway, it's going to go fast from here on out. So buckle your seatbelts, and we'll see you soon. Meeting adjourned.